Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, does Fortet's streaming settlement set a precedent? Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when, if you like to listen to this podcast, the moment it goes live at 7 a.m. on a Monday, you might have noticed that this podcast is late. And this podcast is late because a person...
We don't know who.
...who will remain nameless...
We don't know who.
Chris Cook. Didn't plug their microphone in when we recorded this last week.
It's a mystery. Nobody...
No one really knows, Chris, what happened.
Nobody quite knows what happens.
Oh, I just nearly pulled my laptop off my desk.
Don't do that.
That's a good start. Right, is this going well already? And that's staying in because we're trying to record this on Monday and do it as quickly as we can without mistakes, which we've already failed at. I didn't pull my laptop off the desk, so that's a good start. I'm going to move this cable.
I did confess, because we had an artist entrepreneur day in Hull this weekend, in person. Mm. Great to be doing those events in person again with the Featured Artist Coalition. And I did admit to the audience there that, yes, I'm blaming the fact that I'm moving house. So my setup...
Well, I was going to say that I was coming on to that as well, because that's... Anyway, yeah, you're moving house.
Because
you moved house.
Well, I'm halfway. I'm still in the old house at the moment, but all my stuff is in the other house. So I'm currently living in one house and everything I own is in another house. So whenever...
Oh, okay.
Anyway, the point is, the reason why that's relevant is I have my desk set up to record things like podcasts and webinars, and I kind of taken that down. This is why I'm blaming the fact that not only did I manage to record a podcast without plugging my microphone into the player that we record on, it was only when I opened the WAV file 3 hours later and it was silent 30 seconds after going, why the hell is this WAV file silent? It then clicked in my brain and it was like, oh yeah, I never plugged a microphone. Mm. So we're recording this late. Andy's going to have to edit it in record time. So if anybody from the Guinness Book of Records is tuning in, this is the week when Andy Malt might get the record for the fastest edited podcast, a.k.a. no editing at all. There's going to be a lot of mistakes in this edition. But it does mean, by us being late, that the Glastonbury Festival has now happened, whereas had it been normal recording schedule, the Glastonbury Festival was kind of happening as we recorded. I think you probably watched a bit of it on the BBC. Can you give us your six-word review of the 2022 It's Back Glastonbury Festival?
Six words?
Well, we're on a deadline, aren't we?
Yeah, I watched a lot of it. You know, it was a lovely sunny weekend, so I didn't go outside.
And you didn't have a podcast to edit, thanks to me.
And I did, yes.
Screwing
but now,
that up.
Obviously, there's not time to watch all of it, but it's all on iPlayer. So you're now cutting into my time. Your error is cutting into my time catching up with all of the performances.
You've got to watch more of it live. What are you talking about?
Yeah, no, that's good. It was, well, I mean, I watched, I've caught up with quite a lot of it already.
Paul McCartney's headline set was divisive. This is based on my social feeds. I didn't watch any of it.
Quite dull.
Quite dull. Kendrick Lamar was brilliant. That's what my
incredible
social feed are telling me.
Yep.
So maybe I'll watch that if I only watch one
you
thing.
You should watch that. Yeah, everyone should watch that. That was brilliant. Billie Eilish was good as well. She was very good. But my sister went and watched it there and said it didn't really feel like a Glastonbury headline set, which I agree with. It was clearly her doing the same show she'd just been doing on tour. But it was still really good. And who else was good? Confidence Man, very good. We should watch that set. You'd like them. Confidence Man. Who else was good? Megan Thee Stallion was really, really good. It was the one thing I didn't feel I could show my kids, though. But I don't mind a little bit of swearing, but it was...
slightly too sweary for young children.
Next level content. What else was
You've had well more than six words now.
I know.
One other highlight moment?
One other highlight. Who was really good? I can't think now. I can't think.
Diana Ross was doing the sort of old person slot.
Yeah, I'm not that interested. Maybe I'll watch that.
Pet Shop Boys were doing the other stage. Am I right in saying
that? Well, I was watching Kendrick Lamar, but I did see a bit of them and they were good. Years and Years was good. Alan and the Sniffers, good. Saw a bit of Youngblood. It was all right. Kids like him, don't they? It's good. There's loads of good stuff. And you can probably pick what things you... Oh, Little Sims, of course. How can I not mention Little Sims? She's always good. So, and now there's a whole show to watch on iPlayer. So go and do that.
What a rigorous, in-depth review of the Glastonbury Festival there from Andy Mould. Only possible because I fucked up the original recording of this podcast. So you can all thank me for being able to have such insightful and intellectual overview of this year's Glastonbury Festival on this edition of Setlist.
Yes. But anyway,
you'll be pleased.
We're already on a deadline.
You'll be pleased to hear
another deadline.
Based
on lots of talking over each other. You're not editing the talking over each other.
You'll be pleased to hear, listeners to Setlist, that this year's Glastonbury Festival is not what we're here to talk about this week.
No, no. What we're here to talk about, let's talk a bit more about how you fucked up. Anyway,
we're not here to talk about that either.
I'm going to try to get this out as close to the second we finish recording it as possible. So all of this is going in.
I look forward to... I don't listen to the podcast, so it doesn't bother me.
Anyway, you just say that's not what we're talking about, and I'll start.
Okay. That's not what we're here to talk about this week.
No, later on we'll be discussing Belgium's decision to add equitable remuneration to streams and Impala's plea to other European countries not to follow suit. But first, last week, Domino Records settled its legal battle with Fortet over what royalty he should be paid on streams. The indie label has agreed to pay a 50% royalty, which is what the musician argued he was due under his 2001 record deal. The label had previously been paying him 18% of any streaming income generated by his Domino-released records, that's three albums. However, the company insists that this settlement does not set any precedent for how artists should be paid in general.
So yes, let's quickly recap what this dispute was all about before we get into what happened last week. So Fortet, real name, Kieran Hebden, so we will probably refer to him from this point onwards as Hebden, so you know that's Fortet. So he sued his old label Domino in 2020, basically arguing that it was incorrectly interpreting the 2001 record deal that he signed with the label 20 years ago, and as a result of that, they were paying him the wrong royalty rate on his streaming income. Of course, he was by no means the first artist to raise this gripe. Indeed, plenty of other artists have argued that their record deals that predate the streaming boom, and in many cases predate digital music entirely, have been interpreted wrongly by their record labels, and as a result, they are not getting as big a royalty as they should do. And I mean, one of the reasons why artists make that argument is, well, I guess, if a record deal was done in the physical era, when the main revenue stream was selling CDs, or if it's older than that, cassettes, vinyl, etc., and the royalty rate that's being applied to digital income is the royalty rate that was previously applied to CDs or whatever, well, clearly, when a label is monetizing its recordings digitally, it does not have as many costs, it doesn't have quite the same level of risk as it does when it's releasing physical product. And so plenty of artists and managers and lawyers representing artists have argued over the years that where labels are taking pre-digital record contracts and applying a physical royalty rate to streams or even downloads, well, the argument is artists should be getting more because the label's costs and risks are lower in the digital domain.
Now, a more specific version of that digital royalty dispute, which was relevant in the Fortet v. Domino case, is what we call the sales versus license debate. So old record contracts often had one rate for when recordings were sold and another for when recordings were licensed, with the latter much higher than the former. So in the case of Hebden's 2001 deal, the rate on a sale was 18%, whereas the rate on a license was 50%. In those old deals, a sale basically referred to the sale of physical products, so vinyl, cassette and CD, while a license traditionally referred to sync deals, or when tracks were licensed to another label's compilation, or if a record was licensed to another label for release in another market. However, a record company's deals with the streaming services are also clearly licensing deals, so many artists have argued that the higher license rate should also apply to streams. There's been plenty of litigation regarding the sales versus license debate over the years, albeit mainly in the US, and often involving old record contracts that don't mention digital at all. However, with Hebden, the standard royalty provisions that accompanied his 2001 contract did actually set a rate for downloads, which was 18%.
Yeah, and as a result, Domino argued that the 18% rate that was in that document for downloads should also apply to streams, even though streams weren't actually mentioned. The rationale being that a stream is technically a download that then deletes itself once it has been played. And I mean, technically, they are right. That is how streaming works. So therefore, they were saying, because there was a download rate in this 2001 contract, because downloads were starting to appear on the scene at that point, we should apply that 18% download rate to streams as well. But Hebden countered that because there was no specific provision in that record deal for streams, the licensing rate, because there was a licensing rate in the deal, the licensing rate should apply, and that was the 50% royalty, as we said. And to that end, he sued the label, and his aim from the lawsuit was to get court confirmation that his interpretation of that 2001 record deal was the correct interpretation. Now, as the case proceeded, some extra complications emerged over the core debate as to which royalty rate should apply. At one point, Domino removed Hebden's recordings from the streaming services and offered to pay back royalties on the previous streams at the 50% rate, but said, if we pay you, basically the difference between 18 and 50% on previous streams, and then we stop streaming your music, well, now there's no actual active dispute between us, and therefore the courts should dismiss this litigation because we are no longer at dispute. But it has to be said, it was when Domino removed the Fortet recordings off the streaming services that what had been a story covered by the music business press, like CMU, suddenly became a much bigger deal. And the wider music press and some of the other more mainstream media started covering this dispute when those recordings disappeared from the streaming services. And needless to say, Hebden was quite critical of that decision to remove his recordings because of a legal technicality, and so the whole thing came to much wider attention when that happened.
Yeah, plus the Hebden side hit back, arguing that actually there was now an additional dispute to take to court, that being the dispute over the label removing his recordings from the streaming services. At a court hearing late last year, his lawyer argued, in addition to underplaying their client, Domino was now in breach of contract and liable for so-called restraint of trade for taking down his recordings. The judge overseeing the case rejected the restraint of trade claim, but said Hebden could add the extra breach of contract claim in relation to the removed recordings to his lawsuit. Those recordings subsequently returned to the streaming services while the legal battle proceeded. However, the extra elements to the dispute delayed things and risked pushing the whole case over to the main High Court. And such a shift to that main High Court would have been a big deal for Hebden, because the dispute so far had been pursued within the Specialist Intellectual Property Enterprise Court. And that was key for Hebden because it meant that any potential liabilities to cover the other side's legal costs were capped. But had the matter moved up to the main court, the potential liabilities would have become untenable for Hebden, who would likely have been forced to abandon his lawsuit. So on one level, Domino could have pushed to get the case moved to the main court. And when it proposed such a move at last year's court hearing, the judge seemed to be erring towards backing that proposal, and in doing so, probably would have killed the case. However, even when Domino seemed to be in a stronger position in terms of the legalities, once the litigation was in the public spotlight, you know, in all of the music press, it was definitely losing the PR battle. Even more so once it had removed Hebden's recordings from the streaming services, because whatever the legal reasons for doing so, the musician's fans were much more likely to agree with his lawyer, who told the court last year that that move was deliberate, cynical, and outrageous.
All of which means, even if the label felt that it could possibly defeat Hebden's litigation in one way or another in court, Achieving something nearing an amicable settlement became a much more attractive option for Domino's owners. This whole dispute was also unfolding, as regular listeners to Setlist will know, as the whole economics of streaming debate was underway in the UK Parliament on the back of things like the Broken Record and Fixed Streaming campaigns. And although that parliamentary review of the streaming music market, led by Parliament's Culture Select Committee, covered many different things, because there are many different elements to the economics of streaming debate, it has to be said that the thing that got the most attention in Parliament was how labels and artists were sharing that streaming income, which is allocated by the services, to recordings, and whether or not the approach that some or many labels have taken in that domain is or is not fair. So that timing meant that not only was the Fortet v Domino case getting lots of press, and in most cases, bad press for Domino, it also actually became a political story, and the whole thing was getting mentioned in political circles as well. And with all of that in mind, it was perhaps unsurprising that whatever the pros and cons and the strengths and weaknesses of both sides' legal arguments, that Domino was going to try and get a settlement on this dispute at some point.
So writing on Twitter last week, Hebden said, "I have a bodacious update on my case with Domino Records. They have recognised my original claim that I should be paid a 50% royalty on streaming and downloads, and that they should be treated as a licence rather than the same as a CD or vinyl sale. It has been a difficult and stressful experience to work my way through this court case, and I'm so glad we got this positive result, but I feel hugely relieved that the process is over." He then posted a court filing in which Domino's lawyers stated that on all streaming and download income in respect of which our client has not yet accounted to you, our client will pay a royalty rate of 50%. Meanwhile, regarding past digital income, our client will pay you the sum of £56,921.08, calculated to be the difference between royalties which would have been payable at the 50% rate you claim and what has been paid at the 18% rate to date.
Now, technically speaking, this was a Part 36 settlement, which, as I'm sure you're all aware, is a legal mechanism that incentivized Hebden to take the deal. If you're not aware, maybe some of you are not aware, Hebden's legal advisor Anish Patel actually explained in a statement last week what that means. He said, "The way a Part 36 works is that if he declined the offer but achieved the same result at trial, he would have had to pay all of Domino's legal costs from that point onwards. However," he added, "the settlement that was offered, although it was done in a way that incentivized Hebden to take it, was nevertheless more or less what the musician had been asking for from the beginning." Although we should note, Hebden didn't get everything that he would have wanted. Ideally, and he admitted this on Twitter last week, he would have liked to have negotiated his recording rights back in those albums that Domino released so that he would become the copyright owner. And he did say on Twitter, "Sadly, Domino still own parts of my catalogue for life of copyright and would not give me an option to take back ownership. I hope these types of life of copyright deals become extinct. The music industry isn't definitive, and given its evolutionary nature, it seems crazy to me to try and institutionalise music in that way."
But on the core dispute over royalty rates, the settlement is a win for Hebden, and that immediately poses the question, does this set any kind of precedent that could benefit other artists stuck in old record deals? Legally speaking, the answer, sorry to disappoint you, is no, because the core sales versus licence question was never discussed, let alone answered in court, which was something Domino pointed out in its own statement about the settlement. The label told Billboard, "Domino are pleased that Kieran Hebden has chosen to settle his 2020 claim and accepted financial terms first offered to him in November 2021. Kieran's claim arose from differing interpretations of specific clauses in a contract entered into by Kieran and Domino in 2001 in the pre-streaming era and the application of those clauses to streaming income. Since 2021, it went on, Kieran has added to and pursued his claim despite numerous attempts by Domino to settle the matter. Neither the courts nor the settlement terms have made any determination as to how streaming should be categorised or streaming income split. The case now having been settled, we are glad to be able to dedicate our full attention to resourcing and supporting our artists, and we wish Kieran continued success in his career."
Still, although no legal precedent has been set here because the key argument was never argued in court, because the settlement wasn't hidden behind one of those pesky NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, which settlements like this often are in the music industry, because it's all in the public domain, this settlement possibly will encourage other artists who are stuck in similar old record deals, who are likewise getting physical rates or download rates on streams. It might encourage those artists and their managers and their lawyers to get on the phone and see if they can try and renegotiate and get a better rate. Meanwhile, as we mentioned, all of this was happening during and therefore became part of the wider economics of streaming debate. Following the parliamentary inquiry and the report that they published a year ago in which they called for a reset of the way digital music and streaming music works, various committees have been convened and research reports commissioned by the UK government. The UK government's preference is a voluntary agreement within the music industry to deal with the concerns around the remuneration of artists on streaming income. And things like this, I feel, will empower the various artists and musician and songwriter groups who are pushing for a better deal, both specifically and generally within the UK music industry. And therefore, it could actually have an impact in some way on that ongoing conversation and any agreement that is reached. And it therefore might help more artists to get a better rate on streaming, probably not 50-50 split, but nevertheless, possibly a better rate on streaming without having to go through the hassle and cost and risk of actually pursuing litigation. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not this settlement, although it doesn't technically set any legal precedent, might nevertheless have an impact on the ongoing conversation around the economics of streaming and artist remuneration.
And finally, on this edition of Setlist, talking of the wider debate around fair remuneration in the digital music space, as we were, there have been some interesting developments in that domain around Europe in recent weeks that we haven't discussed in detail here on Setlist, so we thought we'd do that now. Partly because the Fortet settlement potentially impacts on that debate, certainly here in the UK, and partly because pan-European indie label trade group Impala put out a detailed statement on that ongoing debate last week. Basically, it reckons that any country considering introducing measures to address concerns about fair remuneration should follow the French, but certainly not the Belgians.
Yes, you should always follow the French, never follow the Belgians. I don't know if that applies across the board, but Impala reckons it does apply here. So, as we said, there's been lots of debate and some dispute over the years about what cut of streaming money artists should receive. In most countries, that cut received by the artist depends entirely on whatever deal the artist has negotiated with any record labels or music distributors that it works with. And as a result, the split of the money allocated to anyone recording that is shared with the artist could be anywhere from a few percent of the money to 100% of the money. Although on a conventional record deal, the artist is probably getting a minority cut of the money. There are 50-50 profit share deals out there, and there always have been, particularly in the indie space. But on a conventional record deal, usually the artist would be getting a minority cut. So on a newer conventional deal here in the UK, the artist would be expecting to get somewhere between 20 and 25% of the core revenue streams, like streaming. Although on older deals, as we saw with that Fortet deal from 2001, the artist cut is likely to be lower than that. So that was 18% in Fortet's case, but it could be 15% if it was from the 90s, 12% if it was from the 80s. Basically, the older the deal, the lower the rate the artist is likely to get, assuming the label has decided to apply what was the CD or vinyl or cassette royalty to streaming income.
Now, as we've discussed on Setlist before, there have been various proposals for how aggrieved artists could get a better deal. Many in the indie label community support voluntary initiatives, such as labels paying a minimum modern royalty rate to all artists with recordings in their catalogues, oblivious of what any old record deals say, and also writing off unrecouped advances and costs after a period of time. Some indies, most notably Beggars Group, already do both of those things. Others have proposed reforming copyright law to help artists get a bigger cut of the money. Possible reforms include providing artists with a right in law to renegotiate old record deals after a period of time, or to cancel old deals and reclaim the rights in old recordings, Or there is the alternative proposal that the performer ER right that already exists for broadcast and public performance income should be extended to streams so that artists would get at least some of their streaming income directly via the collective licensing system at industry standard rates.
Now, here in the UK, I mentioned that following the Economics of Streaming Inquiry in Parliament, the government commissioned a bunch of research about artist remuneration, and that research is looking into all three of those copyright law reform proposals you've just mentioned, contract adjustment, reversion right, and ER, because all three were recommended in the parliamentary report on the economics of streaming and also included in the bill that was put to Parliament last year by one of the members of the Culture Select Committee, Kevin Brennan MP. Although the government is researching those copyright law reforms and has said that they're not off the table yet, but nevertheless, the government's preferred option would be for the industry, labels and services and distributors and artists and songwriters and publishers, etc., to come together and to agree some sort of voluntary agreement rather than changing copyright law. Now, as we say, some indies are already applying a minimum royalty rate, a modern minimum royalty rate, to all recordings in their catalogue, oblivious of what record deals say, like Beggars. And the majors in the last year or so have all committed to start paying through royalties to artists on old deals who haven't recouped any advances or costs on those deals. So there have been some moves over the years and in the last year within the industry to voluntarily deal with some of these concerns. Although it does feel at the moment, certainly with the majors, despite the commitment on unrecouped artists, and although some indies are already doing the minimum rate thing, it does feel like artist groups and musician groups are pushing for a bigger commitment from the UK music industry, from the label community, than they've currently seen across the board for any sort of voluntary agreement that would happen instead of copyright law reform.
But as we mentioned, there have been some interesting developments in all this elsewhere in Europe in recent weeks. Firstly, in France, a voluntary agreement has been reached between labels and performers that will result in a number of new industry standards, including a minimum royalty rate and some kickbacks for session musicians who don't usually earn anything from streams under the current system. That agreement took years to negotiate, and the wider industry is still figuring out exactly what it will mean in practical terms. But supporters of that approach say it provides a good framework around which to build a fairer digital music economy. Meanwhile, in Belgium, earlier this month, the country's parliament introduced a new performer ER right on streams, meaning that streaming services will now pay a portion of their revenues directly to performers, most likely through the collective licensing system.
That new ER right in Belgium was added as the country finally got round to implementing the 2019 European Union Copyright Directive, which long-time setlist listeners will remember. When that directive was being negotiated back in the day a few years ago, some musician groups and performer groups campaigned for a new pan-European ER right on streams to actually be inserted into the directive. However, that was not included in the final draft. But there is an article in that directive that says that EU member states must ensure that performers receive appropriate and proportionate remuneration from the exploitation of their work. Now, that's a very vague obligation. And what most EU countries have done as they've taken that directive and then amended their national copyright laws to bring them in line with European law, that's what happens with directives. What most EU countries have done is simply cut and paste that line about appropriate and proportionate remuneration into their national copyright laws, and then not really said anything about how that remuneration, proportionate and appropriate, might be achieved. And I guess in doing so, are basically implying that lawmakers in those countries think that under the current system, artists are already getting appropriate and proportionate remuneration. But some EU countries have actually inserted some extra elements into their national laws as part of the implementation of that article of the directive. So, for example, Germany has added a new ER right for performers specifically linked to user upload platforms like YouTube. And initially it looked like Belgium was basically going to follow Germany's lead and do the same thing, except that once that proposal was in the Belgian parliament, they decided to apply a new ER right to all streaming services, not just user upload platforms. Now, that's not unprecedented. There are a couple of countries in Europe who have been doing that for years pre the directive. So Hungary and particularly Spain already have ER rights that apply to streams. And we expect this new ER right in Belgium to basically work like the ER right already works in Spain. So what that means is labels will continue to license their music to streaming services. They will be paid when that music is streamed. They will share the money they receive with their artists subject to contract. But in addition to that, performers will have their own deal with the streaming services, as we say, through a collecting society, most likely. So a small portion of the total streaming pot, or digital pie if you prefer, will be handed over to that society each month and then filter through the system to performers, which means that performers will get some of their streaming income directly, oblivious of what record deals they've done, even if they've not recouped on an old record deal, even if they're a session musician who wouldn't normally be getting any money. And then what usually happens is once the services are paying that little bit of money through the collective licensing system directly to performers each month, when their next set of deals come up for renegotiation with the record labels, they usually look for the labels to provide a discount equal to the extra payment that they're having to make directly to performers.
The deadline for implementing the 2019 directive into each EU member state's national copyright laws was actually a year ago, but 12 countries are still working on it. Pro-ER campaigners are hoping that more countries might now follow Belgium's lead by providing a new ER right on streams rather than just pasting that generic line about appropriate and proportionate remuneration into law. That includes EPO Artist, which is the pan-European grouping for the collecting societies that specifically represent performers. And welcoming the developments in Belgium, its General Secretary Jon Kees said, "The only excuse to be late in the implementation of the EU directive is the search for the best additional measures to protect performers in the online environment they are increasingly dependent on." He then added that the Belgian approach is the most comprehensive and effective implementation of the directive, adding, "This is a model that the 12 countries that have yet to implement could adopt and demonstrate to those who have opted for literal transposition that achieving a directive's objectives is more important than achieving its deadline."
Now, as we've discussed on Setlist many, some people would say too many times.
It's possible.
It's possible. There are both pros and cons to the ER approach in streaming, and the label community is generally opposed to ER being applied to digital income, like streaming income. They would argue that doing so will negatively impact on their ability to invest in new artists and will mean that there is much less flexibility when it comes to negotiating deals. Plus, those artists who basically run their own labels and then work with music distributors could actually be worse off under the ER system once the costs of administrating ER have been paid. And it was based on those arguments, basically, that Impala last week called on those countries that are still to implement the directive to not use that process to introduce a new ER right, like has happened in Belgium. Instead, they said in a statement, those countries should insert the various elements of the directive dealing with performer rights, as well as the separate Article 17 of the directive, which, as we've discussed infinitum on Setlist, deals with the copyright safe harbour. All of that should be done swiftly and faithfully according to the text of the directive. They went on, "The directive has a full performer package, including the principle of appropriate and proportionate remuneration that we've already talked about, which is Article 18 of the directive, and which, Impala likes to stress, rejected a new right to equitable remuneration when that bit of the directive was being finalised. Plus, there are transparency obligations in Article 19, contract adjustment mechanism in Article 20, and the right of revocation, basically a use it or lose it clause, in Article 22. Impala has fully supported this package from the beginning, it went on, but does not agree with grafting additional rights, such as new rights for collecting societies or performers to negotiate with digital services for a parallel fee, so-called equitable remuneration.
Impala then said that the best way to achieve the appropriate and proportionate remuneration described in Article 18 of the EU directive is via an agreement within the industry similar to that negotiated in France. The French agreement, it said, aims both at creating value and the conditions of balanced value sharing. This historic and consensual agreement was concluded by the whole French industry, including artists and labels, with Impala member UPFI. It is a negotiated solution addressing value in the digital music chain for the first time. The absence of equitable remuneration in the French Accord underlines that there is no place for this in a modern music market, as it would prove disastrous for the local market, it added. This is something that was already rejected by all three EU institutions in their negotiations when the copyright directive was being crafted.
Despite this, Impala then continued, alluding to what's happened in Belgium. Last week, when they were writing this statement, a couple of weeks ago by now, last week, neighbouring Belgium voted a law implementing the directive for which an equitable remuneration provision was added at the last minute with zero consultation or impact assessment. So-called equitable remuneration is simply not equitable in Impala's view. It limits labels' capacity to invest in new music and reduces their revenues along with the revenues of their artists, as experience in Spain has shown. It also doesn't fit with the self-releasing artist business models, which are more prominent in the modern music market. So I think we can say for certain, whatever your opinions are on ER, you can take opinions either way, it's up to you. The debate definitely continues regarding how the streaming music business should work and how artists should be paid and what cut of the money they should get. I'm actually delivering a brand new speed briefing at the brilliant festival and conference called Vilvilvest in Bergen in Norway at the start of September. So I do actually have a vested interest in this debate continuing until at least then. I think that's guaranteed that is going to be happening. So if you're going to Vilvilvest, or if you're not, you should. And I'll be updating people on all the different debates and particularly all the recent developments, including the recent developments we've talked about in this edition of Setlist. And no doubt a bunch of more other recent developments which will happen between now and then.
But that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. If you want to read more about anything we've discussed here, go find the links in the show notes in your podcast player or at setlistpodcast.com. Subscribe to the show, rate the show, review the show, and email us. Email us at setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.